Kristen, here we are, a new year. It's 2013.
I feel good about it.
Do you feel good?
Well, some people don't feel good about me or you.
you may feel differently once we've read out the reader mail and listened to some angry phone calls that we got about the last couple of podcasts that we've done.
People are so mad at us,
Reaper. Oh, boy.
I just hope that in the new year that our listeners still stay with us, because I'm afraid we may have lost a bunch of listeners.
I resolved to make people even angrier.
Ooh.
That's my resolution.
Ooh, listen to you.
That's my resolution for you.
Listen to you, Mr. Fist.
Come on. It's all in good fun.
Oh.
And we also have three movies to review today. So
it's an exciting day.
Let's do this.
Let's do it. But first, let's introduce ourselves. I'm Kristen Meinzer, producer for The Takeaway.
And I'm Rafer Guzman, movie critic for Newsday. And this is Movie Date.
Got a box full of letters. Thinking my right to read. Some things that you might like to see, but they're all addressed to me.
All right. So much to get to today. We have mail. We have movies. But first, we always start with trivia. Last week, in honor of Les Mis, we asked the question, which teen pop princess saw her Broadway dreams come true when she was cast as Eponine in Les Mis on Broadway? And here is the right answer.
This is Mike Salpeter from Atlanta. Forgive the walking sounds. I'm in the middle of a walk. But I did want to answer your trivia question regarding Les Miserables. The teen queen that was in that Broadway show was Debbie, or as she later became known as, Deborah Gibson. And have a great holiday. Take care. Bye.
Mike from Atlanta.
Mike.
Awesome. Mike.
On his daily walk. I like that.
That's so great. We hope that other people listen to us while they're exercising.
I know. That's awesome.
Yeah. You're inspiring me, Mike. This is like a New Year's resolution. I'm going to walk all the time from now on while I watch movies. That's what I'm going to do.
Oh, that everyone else will love that. okay. And then this week's trivia, in honor of one of the movies that we are reviewing, which is On the Road, the first adaptation of the Jack Kerouac novel, we're going to play the connection game, the degrees of separation game. In 2 degrees of separation, can you get us from On the Road to Titanic?
Yes, use those celebrity connections out there. Use them.
From the small indie film to the James Cameron blockbuster. 2 degrees of separation. If you can do it, give us a ring, 5717-MOVIES.
But now, let's move on to the meaty, angry stuff that all of you guys wrote to us, that you called in. We got so many phone calls and emails.
I know. It's really some surprise. Why these movies of all the movies that we've reviewed?
Dozens of them. Dozens
Strange.
Of phone calls and emails. Yeah. So many of them. And, God, the biggest one was The Hobbit. Lots of people wrote and called in about
A lot
the
of people
Hobbit.
Wrote. You want to start with The Hobbit? I'll start with The Hobbit. I'll read a few off. And just so you know, these are other people's words, not mine. Kristen, I'm not saying this to you. I'm just the messenger. Don't shoot me. One of the ones among the many that we got was from Diane T. from Muskegon. I don't know actually where that is. Muskegon. But that's,
I don't know either.
I don't know. She says, I listen to this podcast quite often and have never been so let down. This is to you, Kristen. I think if you fall asleep during a movie, you should be honest enough to recuse yourself.
You know what? That is a very good point. And I would actually totally agree with her if I'd fallen asleep for more than 10 minutes. Now, this is going to sound a little defensive, I know, but my friend I went to the movie with, I asked her point blank. I read a bunch of this listener mail to her. And she said, I want you to know that because you snore so loudly, I didn't let you sleep for more than 3 minutes both times you fell asleep. So she said that I fell asleep in total less than 10 minutes, which is the equivalent of maybe 1.5 bathroom breaks.
But
so I will say, yes, I shouldn't fall asleep during movies. But I'll also say Peter Jackson shouldn't make movies like this.
Oh, snap! Wow. Although to go to Diane T's point, You were in a deep enough sleep to begin snoring, which is saying something. All right.
I was so tired that week. It was a tough week.
And The Hobbit didn't help things for you. All right. The other email that we got, the other message we got was from a regular listener, Sean Proctor, who took offense, took umbrage to one of your comments that you said about the movie. And here it is. To quote, I think if Peter Jackson knew where his bread was buttered, he would put some chicks in there and put them in smaller costumes. A lot of the audience has probably never seen a woman before. Up close, I mean. Those are your words, Kristen. Those are your words.
They are. And Sean, I don't mean to insult viewers of Peter Jackson movies, just as I don't want to be insulted as a viewer of chick flicks. And you're right. You mention actually in your letter, you go further and say, you know, you don't want to put down people who are crazy about middle-aged love story movies, meaning me, because that is me.
That's right. Sean,
totally,
he does note, he does say he's a Tolkien fan, he's a fan of the films, the books, he's a D&D fan, Comic-Con guy, superhero movie guy, but he says, just as importantly, I am also a happily married father of two kids, and I know many men and women with similar interests who have stable, healthy relationships. This notion of geeks and nerds as socially inept shut-ins is at least 10 years out of date, he says.
Oh, and I'm 10 years out of date, actually.
See, Kristen.
So I'm, you know what? I'm really sorry about that, listeners. We got a lot of people who wrote in saying the same thing as you, Sean, saying, don't insult the listeners. Insult the movies if you want to, but don't insult the listeners or the viewers. I apologize. I am sorry. And let's go into the new year with me being a little bit nicer to listeners.
Okay, Kristen.
And like you, a little meaner to the movies.
A little meaner.
Hooray. Speaking of mean, no, we got a lot of calls and emails also about Les Mis. They weren't mean. They were just factually trying to put things in order. And here's one of the phone calls that we got.
This is Kim from Hollywood, California. I just listened to the Les Miserables podcast. But I just wanted to correct you, Rafer, on a couple of things regarding Les Miserables and regarding the French Revolution in general. The French Revolution is not in Les Miserables. Les Miserables takes place years later. The French Revolution started in 1789, approximately, lasted for a decade, known as the Terror. And Les Miserables concerns the June Rebellion, which was in 1832 and lasted for 2 days. It was a student rebellion. So it is not at all the French Revolution.
Wow, Rafer, what do you have to say to Kim and all the other listeners who wrote and called in with this Les Mis factual issue here?
Yes, it was sloppy usage on my part, for sure. It's tough because when I was writing the actual review of Les Mis, I had a hard time figuring out how I was going to say this. The reviews I write are very short, and so I'm always pressed for space. And I kept thinking, how am I going to write this in a way that people can sort of immediately understand? I mean, if I say, oh, it took place during the June uprising, it's just not going to really hit most American readers. It's not going to bring any image to mind.
We don't know our own history, much
right.
less that stuff happening over there.
And if you say, you know, and also if you just say, you know, a student rebellion in Paris sounds very small scale. So I went back and forth because I kept thinking you really can't say French Revolution because that brings to mind the famous one, the famous French Revolution, and this is not that. I think I may in my review have said something like, I hedged a little bit saying, I think, in revolutionary Paris or in revolutionary France, trying to just say, this is during some revolutionary times, but not that big, huge one that you and I all know about.
During rough times over there.
Rough times over there. But it's true. I am guilty of loose usage with the words French Revolution because when you say that, everyone thinks of the Robespierre and the terrorists and all that and the guillotines.
I don't know what you're talking about. See, I'm an American.
That's because you're an American too, Kristen. So I will say that is a point well taken. That is a point well taken. I should have chosen my words more carefully.
All right. Well, speaking of history, we got a lot of letters also about Django Unchained and the fact that we didn't really discuss the slavery history and the peculiar relationships that unfortunately people were forced into during slavery. And there's one character in Django that we didn't discuss who has a very difficult relationship with his owners, played
yes.
by Samuel L. Jackson. And Tony from New York is just one of many people who wrote in. He said, quote, your criticism of Django sucked. You didn't even mention Samuel L. Jackson's performance. You didn't mention the very strong language that was used. You altogether missed the entire context of the film. American slavery and racism made Django, and you didn't talk about it. So let's talk about that, Rafer.
Yeah. Yes, we completely overlooked that. I think we had spent so much time with Les Misérables at that point that we were sort of pressed for time and trying not to create one of these 40-minute podcasts that we occasionally create. And so we wound up truncating that one, and we really should have talked more about that aspect of it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
I think a lot of people. I think A.O. Scott at the Times felt that the movie was really had a lot to say about racism and slavery. I hope I'm not misquoting, but I think he used the word important, that he really felt that this was saying some very important things. I personally would not go that far. I do feel that although the character of Stephen, who is the house slave of Leonardo DiCaprio, that's played by Samuel L. Jackson.
Who has to pick and choose sides, and frequently for his own survival and for maintaining any sense of power and individuality, actually frequently sides with his owner, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And it's a really messed up, unfortunate thing that is part of all sorts of tragic histories where we pick and choose sides, and it's not always the right side.
Yeah, it's a very interesting. He's a very interesting character. Ultimately, I think this movie is essentially an exploitation film, an action film, a shoot 'em up, a splatter film.
I would concur.
And I think Tarantino uses. I think he uses slavery as a way to pump up the action, get your juices flowing, build some rage in you because you see people being victimized, which is a standard trope of the action film and the exploitation film. But I think he does it in a responsible way, without trivializing it, without cheapening it. Despite what Spike Lee has been saying, I think he handles it with dignity, even as he is pushing our buttons.
As he's making a bad movie.
Even as he's making an overlong 2-hour 45-minute film that gets really boring.
Yes.
But this person who wrote in is correct. We should have covered that. We were pressed for time.
And Tony, we apologize. You're right.
We should have been better about that. So let's see if we can do a better job on the three movies that we're reviewing this week, beginning with On the Road.
The only people that interest me are the mad ones. The ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, desirous of everything at the same time. The ones that never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, burn, burn like Roman candles across the night.
That is a clip of our protagonist, Sal, talking all about how much he loves people like Dean Moriarty. No, mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, Dean Moriarty.
Mm-hmm. I always get confused about, like, what are their names in the book?
Right, what are their fake names? What are their real names?
Neil Cassidy. Yeah, Cassidy / Dean Moriarty. Yeah. It's the same one. And for anybody who was a teenager at one point, you probably read this book, or maybe in college. I read it as a teenager. Loved the book at the time. Jack Kerouac's fictionalized, semi-autobiographical book about being young, traveling around the country, being kind of like in a bromance infatuation with his best friend, who's very charismatic, dynamic, a womanizer, a drunk, totally unreliable, uses everybody, and yet he is just kind of obsessed with this guy and living a certain lifestyle. And this movie, a lot of people said, could never be made.
Right.
Because it's not even full of much plot. It's just like, and then we were here. And then we were using drugs. And then we were screwing these girls.
Right.
And then we totally left these girls by the wayside. And then we were all making out again. And look, we're drunk. Hey.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I believe, Rafer, you were looking forward to this movie.
I was really looking forward to this because I'm a big fan of the book. And I think the book is a deeper book than most people give it credit for. And so I was really looking forward to this. And you know, Walter Salles, the director who did Motorcycle Diaries, seems to be appointing himself, you know, kind of the chronicler of classic Bohemia, which I think is cool. And so I was looking forward to that. And I have to say, while there were things I liked about it and I thought the performances were all pretty good, I also felt that the movie just couldn't get beyond the Kerouac beatnik myth. And that is a pretty old myth. That is a pretty old, pretty familiar, pretty tired myth. And I think if you're going to make On the Road at this late date in 2012, you should really bring something new.
Like CGI.
in 3D.
What do you mean, Rafer?
Kristen Stewart in 3D. Well, I think it's just to have everyone hanging around, listening to jazz, you know, popping Benzedrine, drinking a lot of coffee, hugging each other, saying, hey, it's a party, we're getting all drunk and, you know, popping our fingers and dancing and jitterbugging. There's nothing new or exciting or interesting about that. It'd be a little bit like saying, I'm going to make a movie about the 60s, and in it, everyone's going to wear paisley, and they're going to drop a lot of acid, and they're going to say, man, and all the time. And I think you just kind of feel like, okay, but what more can you tell me about this period? What more can you tell me about the Beatniks, the Beat Generation, what they were doing, why they were doing it? There's nothing more being said in this movie other than it was pretty cool, right? These guys were cool. They were so cool because they traveled around and they hugged each other a lot. And isn't that awesome? Wasn't that an awesome thing to be doing back then? So, you know,
Historically put in context. You want there to actually be setting and place and time, which you're right. There's not a lot of context.
I mean, aside from the costumes and the props and things,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
I can see that. You know what I would have liked more of? I would have liked more story, and I would have liked more depth to character.
Yeah.
I just feel like you're the irrational crazy one. You're the one who's got a crush on this person. You're the teenage girl who gets used. You're the adult woman who gets used. And you're the adult woman who just is crazy.
Right,
and
right.
I really would have liked there to be something more than that.
Yeah.
Also, is it just me or was this movie really long?
I didn't, you know, actually, for some weird reason, it didn't strike me as necessarily too long. It's just, but I, you know, and again, that's a matter of taste. It's not really going anywhere, so it's almost hard to like track the movement of time.
It's like being
in the
an
theater.
Awful road trip to nowhere where you start out in Drunkville and you end up in abused land. With little stops along the way, with a little drunky and hitty and a little
I thought Kristen Stewart. I thought everybody was okay. Kristen Stewart was okay as this sort of ill-used sex pot. I thought I'm going to forget his name. Sam Riley. Sam Riley. Thank you. I thought he was good as Sal Paradise. I thought Garrett Hedlund was pretty good as Dean Moriarty.
I thought so too. Yeah.
But you know, I'm gonna pick one nit at the end of the movie. I don't think I'm not spoiling anything. At the end of the movie, Sal Paradise takes that scroll, the famous scroll that Jack Kerouac wrote on, inserts it into his typewriter, begins typing, and he types the first sentence, I first met Dean not long after my father died. Okay, that is not the opening line of On the Road. It's the opening line of the scroll, the original scroll. But the opening line of the original scroll is not, I first met Dean. It's, I first met Neil Cassady. And why are you, Sal Paradise, a fictional character writing Jack Kerouac's book?
I can't believe you
caught that. It doesn't make
that.
Any sense. It doesn't make any sense.
I can't
and
believe
what it proves,
you caught that.
What it proves is that this movie is so far up into its own myth that it can't even separate fact from fiction. Do you know what I'm saying?
I can't believe you caught that, Rafer.
Yes,
That's awesome.
It's an important thing.
You should be. Are you those people? Are you one of those people who goes onto IMDb and puts like, "This is a continuity error"? Are you one of those?
It's not even a continuity error. I feel like this movie could not. It lost track of the fact that Sal Paradise is not Jack Kerouac. But the other thing is, more importantly, it doesn't think you care, and so it doesn't care. It doesn't care to draw a distinction, and that bothered me. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
okay.
It seems like we both hated it, but for different reasons.
We both hated it for slightly different reasons. You're right. Okay.
Oh, so we kind of agree. Bad date.
Bad date.
I'm going to say it's a pretty bad date. All right. So next movie on the roster. This is The Impossible.
I promise you that I won't stop looking until I find them, okay?
Okay.
I don't know what I'm going to do because it's night time now, but I'll look in all the hospitals and I'll look in all the shelters and everything, okay? And I will find them, I promise you that. I'll call you when I do.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, so The Impossible. This is about the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. We have a family that's vacationing at a high-end resort. They are just trying to enjoy Christmas. The tsunami comes. They deal with extreme physical injuries, separation, wondering who's dead, who's alive, and really just trying to survive.
Trying to survive and trying to get back together. The mother, played by Naomi Watts.
Father, played by Ewan McGregor.
Ewan McGregor. They get separated. Henry has two kids. Maria, Naomi Watts, she has one kid, the oldest, and they're both separated. You know, who knows how far apart? Who knows? You know, they don't know where each other went. They both, as far as they know, just vanished. They're trying to get back together, hoping the others are still alive, and based, I should say, on a true story, the true story of a Spanish family that was
they
vacationing.
They changed the names, and they changed the – made them British in the movie.
They made them British, yeah. I think you liked this film, Kristen.
You know, I went into it filled with dread. I thought, my God, we have an awesome job. We're so lucky we get to review movies for a living, but this is not one that I wanted to review.
Sure.
I don't like watching perfectly nice people get tortured, and I especially hate seeing children in peril. Watching a movie where people who are decent are just tortured, I don't enjoy that in the slightest. And I went into this just really not looking forward to it, but I thought the movie did such a fantastic job with the characters, with what they had to go through. The little boy who plays the oldest son, Lucas.
Tom Holland. He's really good.
The one with Naomi Watts. He's so good. And
and their relationship is actually very interesting, I think, in the film.
Oh, I thought it was fantastic. And I think that's probably the main reason I really was able to stick through the film was because their relationship was so amazing to watch, and that little boy is such a good actor.
Yeah.
Also, I thought that they did a good job of I know they didn't show enough of the people in Asia, the tens of thousands of people who were displaced and killed in Asia, but the parts that they do show, I mean, they really make this – the family is the focus. The vacationers are the focus. But what they do show of those in Asia are just amazing moments of – human decency and generosity and kindness and trauma and it's so well done. There's a moment where Naomi Watts is so injured and there is a local community that finds her, and I won't say anything more about it than that, but and I think that's when the waterworks really started for me, and then I just continued crying for the rest of the movie. I was bawling and bawling and bawling and bawling through this movie, and I enjoyed it. I don't know. Enjoy is not the right word.
Right. Well, yes, right.
That's not the right word. But
some of it's very difficult to watch. I mean, it's interesting for what is essentially, you know, it's I would classify this as an inspirational film. It's a feel good film, I think. The director J.A. Bayona is a Spanish director. He's actually a horror film director. He did The Orphanage from a couple of years ago, maybe.
That makes sense that he's a horror director.
It's got a little bit of a horror film flair to it here and there, right? When she's coughing up this black gunk out of her lungs, a horrifying scene. The film is also a film that's pretty gruesome, pretty violent, pretty tough going in a lot of ways, especially for what, again, is a kind of an inspirational film. Now, you know, you and I were on the takeaway already, and my criticism of this film is that it was too white. There's something weird to me about taking this one white, wealthy family that just happened to be really lucky and focusing on them while 230,000 darker skinned victims, for the most part, across South Asia, you know, were killed. In most of what you see of them, again, you do see a lot of help from rescue workers, from hospital staff, but, you know, again,
I know what you're saying.
The vast
majority of the victims were not white tourists.
Right.
The vast majority.
And the only other ones we talk to, again, there's a reason for this. The only other ones we talk to who speak English are also white tourists who happen to be vacationing
there. Lots of blue-eyed people. I actually at one moment did realize, I don't think they cast a single brown-eyed person in this movie except for the Asians.
There's
lots
corpse
of
number 60.
Blue eyes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it's not that I didn't notice that. And I did take some issue with that. But then I thought, you know what? It's not an ideal situation. There's something not quite right about that that didn't sit right with me. But at the same time, I thought, I'm just going to let myself focus on these characters. These characters are so good.
Sure. And this is Hollywood. It's Hollywood. It's a movie. You got to sell it. you know, if you can get Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor, you're going to go for them instead of, you know, two actors from Thailand that no one's ever heard of or whatever.
It's unfortunate. I've had that thought in a lot of movies over the years. Mm-hmm. There was a movie, oh my gosh, I think it was Dennis Quaid, and it was about the Japanese internment, but of course he's the star. Or Heaven and Earth, a movie about Vietnam. And of course, it's not about the book originally, Heaven and Earth, When Heaven and Earth Changed Places, is an autobiography from a Vietnamese woman. And in the movie, it's all Tommy Lee Jones as an narrator. Right. Like, and I understand, Hollywood just does this over and over and over and over and over again. And I don't like it. But in this particular movie, I was willing to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
The acting was good. The story was good. And, oh, God, that little boy actor. I just loved him.
Yeah.
And I cried and cried for that boy.
Yeah, he was good. And we should also, just to point this out, because awards season is upon us, Naomi Watts getting a lot of buzz for this.
Oh, yeah.
Golden Globe nomination. Yes. And I think some people are thinking probably an Oscar nod as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
I wouldn't be surprised. So I would say Good Date.
Yeah, I would say an okay date. I would say a good date.
But I will say, like, technically, like, if we're going to be literal here, don't go on a date and see this. There's going to be no making out after this movie.
That's right.
None of that stuff.
Okay, so we've got Promised Land to finish up with. We saved the biggest names for last. Matt Damon, John Krasinski, not only the stars, but the co-writers with Dave Eggers, directed by Gus Van Sant. Who else is in it? Oh, Rosemary DeWitt as the love interest.
And so let's not forget Mark Twain.
Right, Hal. I forgot Hal Holbrook. Oh, Kristen.
Here's a clip.
Mr. Richards, I'm just being straight with you. It's simple math. Best case scenario, there's $30 million under your town. 0.1% of that is $30,000. That's what I'm authorized to offer you. I'm also telling you it's a one-time offer.
All right. So that's Promised Land. Kristen, do you want to give a summary of this?
Yeah, sure. So we have in a small town farming USA, a big natural gas company coming in offering to buy up all these poor farmers who are receiving subsidies from the government. And, you know, it's hard times to be a farmer in America right now. And the main rep for the natural gas company is played by Matt Damon.
Right.
With his partner in crime, let's not forget.
Oh, Frances McDormand.
Yes, Frances McDormand.
Who's great.
Who's great. And they're trying to convince people in the community to sell the rights to their land or the rights to the oil underneath their land, the natural gas underneath their land.
For fracking.
And I just, full disclosure, this is an anti-fracking movie. Full disclosure.
Well, now you've spoiled a few things, but okay.
What? Should I not say that? Anybody who sees a trailer can see that this is an anti-fracking movie.
I know what you're saying.
If you've seen a trailer, it's an anti-fracking movie.
Yes. All right.
Should we just erase that from the podcast?
No. You're right.
Anybody who's seen a trailer knows this is anti-fracking. But I will say this. There is some effort made to show the poor farmer's point of view as far as, like, why would a poor farmer be willing to completely risk devastating their land.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand at some points in the movie, there are arguments made for, of course you know why.
Right.
Because it sucks being a poor farmer.
Right.
It sucks not thinking that you can send your kid to college. It sucks thinking, can we afford clothes or a new car? Can we afford a lot of stuff? And so some effort is made in the movie to show that perspective.
I think that's true. I think the movie tries to provide at least some forceful arguments on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And we're forgetting John Krasinski, who plays Dustin Noble, who is a cagey environmentalist who comes into the town and starts to stir things up against Matt Damon and Frances McDormand. And you know, there is some attention paid to the way that the big gas company, Global Cross Power Solutions, is their name.
I love that name.
I know it's a great sort of generic, you know, ominous sounding name. There's some attention paid to the way that they are sort of sweet talking, perhaps hoodwinking people, brushing a few unpleasant facts under the rug, but also how Dustin Noble, this environmentalist, is overblowing things, oversimplifying things, using scare tactics. There's what I thought was a very funny scene where he comes into a classroom to prove his point to some children, pours flammable liquids over a plastic farm diorama and then lights it all on fire. Say, look, there's your farm, a bunch of flaming plastic cows. I thought that was kind of funny and meant to be, I think, a good example of hyperbole on both sides.
I thought John Krasinski was great in this. Yeah, John Krasinski was perfect for this.
He was actually pretty good. I thought everybody was quite good, and
Matt Damon I liked a lot.
I always love Matt Damon. This is a great part for him. You know, he's playing a guy who has Iowa roots, and so now he kind of prides himself on being the guy who knows how to talk to these salt of the earth folks.
And he still wears his grandpa's farm boots.
Right.
He knows what it's like to be a poor farmer.
Right, and he sort of meets his match in this environmentalist character. But I think, to go to your point, Kristen, what bummed me out ultimately about this movie is that aside from all of this kind of sensitivity and even-handedness that it tries to display, it ultimately just goes Hollywood and wraps it all up and decides that, you know, somebody's got to be the villain, and I think we can all guess who that's going to be. It's not going to be the poor farmer. And without spoiling too much, it all just becomes very neat, very black and white, no shades of gray at the end. And it's sort of that the ending, I felt, kind of belied everything the film was trying to do in the first place.
I hope you're not spoiling anything for anyone.
I don't really. Well, as you said, if you've seen the trailer,
you know. It's an anti-fracking movie. It's anti-fracking. Okay.
Right.
Well, I'll say this. I was a little irritated with that. Mm-hmm. I was a lot irritated with that. But for the most part, up until then, I mostly enjoyed the ride.
Me too.
And
me too.
And I really thought the acting was fantastic. I thought mm-hmm. the relationships were well done, with the exception of a really kind of dumb throwaway love triangle, which didn't need to be in there.
Yeah, Rosemary DeWitt's character is not that necessary.
Yeah, but with the exception of that throwaway love triangle with John Krasinski, DeWitt, and Damon, I liked most of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I liked almost all of it, but it wasn't a perfect date.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily even a good date. It was a fine date.
It's an okay date. A somewhat forgettable date, I would say.
Yeah. Unless you're one of those people who really just
hates fracking?
Yeah. If you hate fracking, you might love this movie, actually. Yes. Yeah. If you're an anti-fracker, go see it.
Get you and your date worked up. all right. So there. We've covered the waterfront, Kristen. Should we wrap up with the trivia?
Oh, yes. Let's remind everyone of the trivia question. And by the way, there's more than one right answer for this last trivia question, by the way. I'm not going to tell you, but yeah, we'll tell you next week.
Well, Kristen, you're always the brains behind these. So if you say that's so, then I believe it's so. And the question is, playing 2 degrees of separation, 2 degrees of separation, can you get us from On the Road to Titanic? If you know the answer, give us a call. 5717-MOVIES.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Going places that I've never been. Seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again.